Lake Canal versus DC case. Can I ask the bailiff to set the clock? I think we have 30 minutes aside. You may proceed.
Thank you. Good morning. May it please the court. I'm Richard LaPuma, and I represent the petitioners Lake Canal and Hill in this action. We asked you to review this case out of a strong conviction that a tax deed issued for reservoir property that's not even subject to separate taxation must of necessity be and is in this case void, because it basically constitutes the taking of property without due process. And so when I say void, I mean void in the traditional sense of the word, being an absolute nullity for all purposes. It conveys no title. It conveys no right of possession.
Did the tax deed on its face describe this as reservoir property?
The tax deed does indicate that the property contains reservoir acreage. Yes, it does. In a parenthetical in the description.
I'm looking for that deed. Is that in the record here? I don't.
The deed is, I'm sure it's in the record.
Yeah.
I can't cite the specific today.
But you're representing it. It would put someone on notice that there's a reservoir on this property.
It does. And I can even remember the exact phrase. There's a description of the property, and then at the end of that, it indicates, I think it says 21.1 acres res, R-E-S period. But it does indicate that there is a reservoir contained in this property. And I don't think there's really a question that the assessment here was invalid, that there is a reservoir here and it was not subject to taxation.
I thought there was an argument, though, that this did not appear to be void on its face because only some types of reservoir property are not taxed.
Yes, there was an argument about that, but I'm here to tell you that it's really not a relevant argument to what the issues are that are before the court today.
Why is that true?
Because what we have is a situation where the Court of Appeals said that this deed is voidable as opposed to void, meaning that some party for some limited period of time can come and set it aside, but in the meantime it passes title. The argument that we've raised, of course, is that the deed is void ab initio from the beginning for all purposes, and it doesn't convey title. That's an important distinction. The whole void on its face part of the Court of Appeals decision comes because they look at this case, Chrisman, which is Colorado Supreme Court from about 120 years ago, which talks about when a deed can be set aside, when the statute of limitations applies. And Chrisman was a good case for analyzing this, our case, because it dealt with multiple deeds. Some of the deeds in Chrisman were void on their face for procedural reasons. Some of the deeds in Chrisman were probably voidable because there was some procedural inadequacy, but it didn't appear on the face of the deed. So what Chrisman did was it set out this, what we've called a tripartite rule. Basically, it says that a deed that is void on its face can be challenged after 5 years regardless of the application of the statute of limitations, because the statute of limitations doesn't apply to a deed that's void and isn't capable of conveying title. And it relies on an even older case, Gomer versus Chaffee, which has that great language about how a void deed can't possibly start a statute of limitations running. But then in Chrisman, they also looked at a deed that was jurisdictionally valid. In other words, there was an appropriate assessment, there was an appropriate notice, all the statutory requirements were met. But for some reason, in this case, it was because the sale was made at the offices of the clerk instead of at the treasurer's office, there was a procedural defect. So the rules weren't followed precisely, and the court, and this court in Crispin looked at that and said, well, that's not apparent on the face of the deed, and we think that the statute of limitations was designed to apply to a case like this. And so 5 years passes, and that deed can't be challenged anymore because of the statute of limitations. But, and this is the key provision, in discussing that deed that was probably could be set aside because of a minor procedural defect, but it didn't show up on the face of the deed, Crispin, the court gave this key language. I think it's the key language in this whole case, where they basically said that there are some deeds that cannot be obviated by the statute. In other words, whether it appears on the face of the deed or not. Some deeds are just jurisdictionally deficient. The treasurer who issued that deed did not have the power or authority to issue that deed, and therefore it's basically the same thing as a forgery. And there's another case that you decided more recently, the Upson case, where you said, hey, a forged deed is void, not voidable. It's void for all purposes. It can't convey any title because the person who signs that deed doesn't have the power or authority to
convey. Well, see, I'm interested in that policy argument that, in fact, there must be a valid basis for some kind of assessment, because the only way the government gets the authority to transfer title to property is, in fact, that it has a valid assessment.
That's right.
Or a color of a valid assessment. I'm not exactly sure what the law says on that. Well, but there has to be some basis for the governmental action to be able to convey somebody else's property to a third party for failure to pay taxes.
You're exactly right on point. And in fact, we cited a number of cases in the brief, and they all go directly to that point, starting with the first case, which was Mitchell versus Espinoza. There was a mining claim. There was a mineral deed that was separated from the surface. It had never been assessed. A tax deed was issued without authority, and the court there said that a valid assessment is a prerequisite to issuing a valid deed. And it only makes sense that if the property wasn't validly assessed, the treasurer cannot have the authority to sell it for non-payment of tax.
Okay, having said that, though, that runs against the stability of land titles. And so how do you square that? That, well, there would be an open-ended futuro opportunity to undo the conveyance to third-party bona fide purchaser.
I hear what you're saying, and obviously you're the Supreme Court, so you deal with hard questions like this all the time. What it requires is for you to balance two statutes that have important purposes. Now, we don't deny that the statute of limitations here has an important purpose to promote the stability of the tax proceedings and to secure titles and make them marketable. However, you've got to balance that on the other side against a fundamental constitutional right, whether the state can take property without due process. So when you balance these, I think you see that it's clear that one outweighs the other. Even Ms. Peters is going to have to come up here and confess to you that the statute of limitations isn't completely unassailable, because she's going to agree that when there's a deed that's not void, that is void on its face, it can still be challenged even after the expiration of the statute of limitations.
Well, let me take you back to my question, which we kind of went away from, and that is, I understood your opponent's argument to be that only some types of reservoir property is not taxable. Is that correct? And how do you square that with your argument?
All right. To address that directly, this reservoir certainly is not taxable. There's no dispute about it. I think the argument that was being made there was that conceivably there could be a reservoir that's not used to irrigate the lands of its owner, so that constitutional exemption doesn't apply. So let's say we were talking about some other hypothetical case where there's a reservoir that's, it's hard for me to even think of an example, but maybe a reservoir that's only used for recreational purposes, say. And so that may be taxable at some level because it's not used for irrigation. It's not subject to that constitutional limitation. So I guess my answer is that I'll concede for purposes of the argument that there are some reservoirs that perhaps may be taxed in some cases. But the point that I'm making here is that this reservoir isn't one of those. So here, it's not subject to taxation. Any tax that was imposed by the county treasurer here was absolutely without authority. It was, in fact, a double taxation.
But the reservoir doesn't cover the whole property, correct?
Yes, it does. It does. If you look back at the facts, I know that this was a disputed trial, but again, it was one that was resolved both by the trial court and the Court of Appeals, both saying that this property, none of it was taxable. The reservoir covered, if you look at the decree of the reservoir, it covered at its high mark 93 acres, which is essentially the entire property. So really, that's not an issue either. But I do want to get back to the balancing issue that we were talking about before, because I think this is crucial. Because what you're essentially being asked by Ms. Peters is to implement a bright line rule that says that if the deed is void on its face, it can be challenged. And if the deed is not void on its face, it can't be challenged. And it doesn't matter what the nature of the problem with the deed is. Well, I think that this results in a rule that just doesn't make any sense. Because on the one hand, you've got a deed that's completely valid. Okay, there was a proper assessment which didn't occur here. There was a failure to pay the taxes. The county treasurer was well within its rights to sell this property for unpaid taxes. They followed all the notice requirements. They did everything that the statute requires. But when they issued the deed, they didn't properly dot their I and cross their T. And since that I and that T appear in the face of the deed, you can challenge it after the expiration of the 5 years. But then on the other hand, you've got a deed like you've got here, where the property wasn't even subject to taxation. It was a completely illegal and unauthorized taxation. All appropriate taxes were paid in full. We're only talking about erroneous double taxation here. You have no notices that there was an assessment, no notices that taxes were due, no notices that taxes were delinquent, no notices that a tax lien had been sold, and ultimately no notice of intent to issue the tax deed. But still, because those jurisdictional problems don't show up on the face of the deed, you're going to hold that deed to be merely voidable and 5 years passes and suddenly it becomes a valid deed? I just can't agree with that. And if you take it a step further, you see that the rule really breaks down. Because I'm going to give you a hypothetical that I'll call the evil treasurer hypothetical, which, let's say there's an evil treasurer who's out there with this scheme to issue tax deeds to his accomplice. He has absolutely no authority. Let's say he finds some tax-exempt church property, that there's a parcel that's not being used. It's vacant land, but it's church property. And he issues a deed to his accomplice. The deed looks completely regular on its face. They record it. No one notices it. And 5 years later, you're going to say that that deed can't be challenged? It just doesn't make any sense.
Can I interrupt you just 1 second from over here? You've gone through a number of things saying they don't make sense. You've talked about jurisdictional defects. Ultimately, is all of this a question of construing the statute of limitations that the legislature has provided for us?
I don't think that ultimately that's all it is, but I do think that you can look at the language in the statute of limitations and see that the language itself is self-limiting, because the statute of limitations provides that it only applies to tax deeds that were issued for delinquent taxes. We've got a problem here because this tax deed wasn't issued for delinquent taxes.
And let me just stop you there 1 second, and I'll let you pursue that argument. But you're moving now in the direction of saying, it seems to me, that we can look at the words of the statute and decide why this 5-year statute of limitations does not apply in your case. That I appreciate that as an argument, and I'd like to let you go on and explain to me some of those things. But the other arguments you were making seem to be based on earlier case law or extrapolations and application of terms which seem very ill-defined, like void, or what would be a jurisdictional defect. I'm trying to get a handle of what would be grounds. What is there in this statute that indicates that it doesn't apply or it does apply in this case?
Well, if you're just asking me to only look at the language in the statute, then all I have to hang my hat on is this clause that says that this statute only applies to a case where the land has been sold for delinquent taxes, which did not occur here. So I'm going to tell you that that's what I have. Now, this statute also makes an interesting comment towards the end. If you read through it, there is a clause in there where it says, yeah, but it doesn't stop the deed from being color of title. And you're obviously well versed on color of title because you just had a case on it. But here that plays into the analysis as well, because as I went through and started looking at the cases that say the deed is void, and sometimes you have a case that says a deed could be voidable. And so I tried to look at what makes a deed void, what makes a deed voidable, because you're interested in knowing, as a matter of policy, when it's proper to say the deed is completely void and when to say the deed is voidable. And what you end up looking at is a situation where a void deed would be something like, I mean, this court has held flat out that a forged deed, for example, is void. I think the Upson case is really the best case on this, because it talks about an official of the government who had statutory authority to execute documents that affect real property interests. And you looked at, and in that case, if you remember, it was a public trustee who received a forged request for release of a deed of trust, as well as a forged promissory note that had been marked paid in full, and issued a release of deed of trust. And you have the Court of Appeals saying, well, that's voidable. It's not void. And you're the ones that said, no, that's void.
But isn't that a question? Now you're getting to the heart of kind of what's concerning me. There you're talking about a situation in which we're saying that the party that issued the deed didn't have authority to do so.
That's right.
Either de jure or de facto, one or the other. But he didn't have any authority in that case, even a colorable. But that's not at issue here, right?
Oh, I think it is.
Well, okay, why is that?
This treasurer had no authority to issue this tax.
He wasn't the proper party to issue these kind of tax deeds?
Well, just like the public trustee is the proper party to release a deed of
trust. So by didn't have authority, you mean he didn't comply with the statutory requirements?
Absolutely.
And would there be any statutory requirement? Would any failure to comply with a statutory requirement be what you're referring to as jurisdictional and result in?
Yeah, I think that there are cases that define that, and we have to look at a lot of them because there's a lot of statutes, particularly with issuing treasurer's deeds. But yes, the answer is that we know from lots of case law that any time there was not a valid assessment, like here, that the deed that issues from that invalid assessment is itself void. We know from the Shaw versus Bond case.
And that's old case law that's deciding that. Is that where
you're... All these are Colorado cases, mm-hmm. Yes. Supreme Court cases.
And in those cases, do they offer an explanation why that would result in dubbing it void?
Yes. And if I may be permitted, some of the cases that I cited from other jurisdictions, I thought did a better job of saying why the deed is void. I'm thinking in particular of the California case of Nutting versus Herman, Herman Timber, I believe is the name of the case, where the court said that when you've got an invalid assessment and you have a treasurer who's issuing a deed, but they don't really have authority to do that because the statutory requirements haven't been met, that's confiscation. That's the word they use. That's a confiscation of the property without due process. And you have other cases also giving this strong language that a treasurer who's issuing a deed without the proper underlying authority because the statute wasn't complied with is basically acting, and there's a Latin phrase, I'll try to say it, officii virtuae, basically acting outside their power. And the explanation is that the treasurer acting without authority has no more power to issue a treasurer's deed than I have to issue a deed on your property to Justice Rice. You wouldn't hold that up. If I gave her a deed to your property and I signed it and you hadn't authorized that, I wasn't acting as your agent, 5 years passes by, you're going to say that the statute of limitations gives that deed life? Absolutely not. I think the policy arguments here are very clear. And when you go back and look at the historical context of the cases, you see that every single case that was cited by every party right down to the Court of Appeals, the trial court, Ms. Peters, and by me. Every single case falls into that framework that a deed that's issued without proper authority, without the statutory requirements having been met, with jurisdictional deficiencies, is absolutely void. And I did want to point out that there are some cases that are right on point holding, and this will go back to Chief Justice Mularkey's question about the void on its face issue. There are cases right here in Colorado holding that when a deed is absolutely fine on its face, but is void for these jurisdictional reasons, that that deed does not start the statute of limitations tolling. And the cases I'm thinking of are particularly the Sheasley versus Voorhees case that we cited in our brief. That was a case where notice wasn't given. So that was the statutory problem there. Because the notices weren't given, the court said that's a jurisdictional defect. But the court said, look, this deed looks good on its face. I'm going to concede that it's valid on its face, but I'm still not applying the statute of limitations.
Can I ask you one more question about the statute? What do you think that statute was designed to do? What kind of claims was it designed to bar?
I think that it's, you know, regardless of what I personally think, the cases are clear on what that statute is designed to do. There's four situations that the cases talk about. All right. First, we have the obvious reason of how that statute was designed to apply. You've got a property that was validly assessed, validly taxed. Taxes weren't paid, became delinquent. The treasurer had authority. They went through the process. They followed all the rules. They issued a tax deed, and it's a valid tax deed, valid on its face. 5 years goes by, that tax deed can't be challenged. That's the Fastenau versus Asher case. Basically, that's not what we're talking about here, but I think that's what the statute was originally designed for. Then you've got the three.
What would be the challenge that it's barring under those circumstances?
Well, any challenge at all to the deed. So basically,
not a challenge to the. Procedures that were used in issuing the deed.
Every challenge. In fact, in the Fastenau case, just if you need an example, in the Fastenau case, we basically have a guy who owns property, and he didn't pay his taxes, and he was out of the state. He was out of the state for a period of years. He comes back, he goes to his house or his property, whatever it was, and he finds that it's been sold for a tax deed, but 5 years has passed, so he wants to challenge that, and he says, look, I'll pay the taxes, I should be told. But the court said, no, the statute of limitations applies. You don't have an action.
I don't mean to be argumentative here, but I am not exactly sure that I do understand your argument. If, however, the challenge were that, wait a minute, you shouldn't have issued these taxes in the first place. Now, admittedly, you did issue them, and I didn't pay them, and more than fucking, you know, and then I didn't pay them, and you issued a tax deed to somebody else because they did, and now more than 5 years has passed. But do I understand it? You're saying in that case, though, the statute of limitations would not apply because the issuer of the tax deed would not have had authority because he was doing it on the basis of a tax that he shouldn't have issued in the first place.
That's our case, basically. We have a situation where the treasurer... It's really the assessor here made a mistake. They erroneously assessed a reservoir that's not taxable as pasture land, and they applied a tax to it. They didn't send notices, and nobody paid the taxes, and so they sold a tax lien. No authority there. But I think that case is squarely dealt with by the Chrisman decision and by these other cases, Voorhees and the one that the trial court relied on, which was Scott versus Watkins, another case where the court basically said this deed is regular on its face, looks good, but you didn't follow the rules. In that case, I think the issue was that the publication notice was defective, and the court said statute of limitations doesn't apply here. And so I do think that the whole framework, both in terms of the cases, in terms of the statutes, in terms of our constitutional considerations, and as I discussed briefly, in terms of when a deed should be held void versus voidable, that jurisprudence all lines up and tells us that this deed is void, not merely voidable. Now, I've got about 7 minutes left. I do want to make one more point that I don't think was covered very well in the briefs, but there is this case that troubled me a little bit, Wright versus Yost, which talks about a tax deed that was issued without following the statutory procedures correctly. But it says that the tax deed is voidable. It uses that word voidable. So I was concerned about that. I wanted to go back and read that. And I did. And if you look at that case in the context, you'll see that it only deals with the 7-year statute of limitations, the color of title statute of limitations. So even those cases that the Court of Appeals cited, which was basically right versus use, the case that it relied on was Phillips versus City and County of Denver. Those are the only cases that say that a deed is voidable. They rely on this DeForesta versus Gas case, which we actually cited in our brief, because all that says is that even though this void deed can't produce any title, there's no title, it's absolutely void, but the fact that this piece of paper was recorded can be color of title, that could trigger the 7-year statute of limitations into motion. But it doesn't trigger the 5-year statute of limitations into motion. And in fact, the original case that dealt with that same fact pattern was Bogue versus Miles, where the court held that the tax deed was absolutely void for failure to give notice. And that's the case that you relied on 20 years later in the Clark Concord Corporation versus Huff case, where you said that this void deed doesn't pass any title, doesn't give any right of possession. And so that's where we stand on this.
Before you sit down, I got another question for you, because I'm really confused about who owns what here and who got what when and what is.
It's complicated.
And that is, if this reservoir comprises the whole of the property, how does either Hill or Bethy get any interest in a reservoir that's owned by a reservoir company? And what are we talking about, the recreational rights, the bed of the reservoir? What is really going on here?
All right, it's a fair question, and I know you have a water law background, so you'll certainly understand this, that a reservoir is seasonally used. So there are times in the spring when that reservoir fills up and it's full. It covers the whole property. But there are a lot of times during the year when that reservoir is not completely full. And so the portion of the reservoir property at the north that was adversely possessed way back in the early 1900s by Hill's predecessor, they used it as pasture land. So they put animals, they built fences and corrals. Now, of course, there were times of the year when the water filled up and those things weren't usable. But during the other times, there were uses of the property that were not inconsistent with the use of the property as a reservoir. And so that's how these property interests came into being. We have a situation where the original owner of the property, which was Benjamin Eaton, gave an easement for the reservoir, but then retained for himself and his heirs any uses that are not inconsistent with the use of the reservoir. So there are interests. And so this northern half that had been adversely possessed is actually owned by Hills, but subject to the reservoir easement. And then the lower half, of course, is owned
by Hills. But they don't get taxed on that piece?
They don't get taxed on that piece because it's property that is used for reservoir purposes, and the constitutional exemption has been interpreted that way.
But wouldn't it be just that part of the year in which that property is inundated?
No, that's not how it's been interpreted in the past.
Really? What can you give me for a citation?
Well, even the assessor here, the county assessor in Weld County, said it's our policy. If there's a reservoir on the property, we don't tax it, and you have to go by the scope of the reservoir at full capacity. And there are cases that talk about that, the Shaw case for one, and there's a later case that talks about even property that's around the reservoir that isn't the bed of the reservoir, but it's used for reservoir purposes, that's also tax exempt. So if you have other questions, I'll answer them, but I'd like to reserve my last 2.5 minutes.
You may.
Thank you.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Jennifer Peters, and I am here today on behalf of the respondents, Doug and Therese Beefy, who are the holders of the tax deed in question and have been the holders of the tax deed in question since February of 1997. Based on what I've just heard, I think some review of the facts is important here, and I would point the court and ask you to look at Trial Exhibit 3, which is in the record, I believe, in Volume 1. Which is the map that shows this particular piece of property. And I would also point you to the testimony of the reservoir owners, or the reservoir easement holders, Lake Canal, which is in the supplemental record volume 1, page 94, in which they testified that only 2 months of the year is this reservoir at full capacity. And even at full capacity, it only goes out to the berm, which traps the water in place, and there is property all around that, to the north, to the east, and to the south, that is used for other purposes. To the south, it's farmed. It's been farmed for decades. In fact, it was part of the farm that the Beathys first purchased in 1992, and it's that farmer, Mr. Bruner, who was paying taxes on this entire 50-acre parcel for decades before it came to his attention finally that it, part of the property he was paying taxes on included this Lake Canal Reservoir. And Mr. Bruner was a board member of the Lake Canal Reservoir Company. I think, as it has been pointed out earlier, Mr. Hill and his sister, Ms. Deseran, have adversely possessed the property, according to the trial court, based on their use of the property as for grazing cattle throughout the entire year, not just all parts of the year except the 2 months when it was inundated by water. So I think there's a real issue here that while the specific issue of what property was adversely possessed is not before you, plays into this tax issue of whether the assessor was correct in the first place to say, when the property contains a reservoir but there's significant property around it that's used for agriculture and pasture, is that property subject to taxation?
And so what's the taxing authority's position on that question?
The Weld County Assessor?
Right.
At trial, admittedly, they testified that if there was a reservoir on the property, they would look at the full capacity of the reservoir to determine how much of that property was taxed.
What was the 21.1 acres?
That's what the assessor in this case considered at the time they separated this parcel from the farm to the south. They considered 21.1 acres to be the reservoir bed.
Okay, but when the assessor issued the assessor at that time was looking at it as property that was part of a farm and was being grazed.
And that also had a reservoir on a piece of it, yes.
So there was a color of a valid assessment there, if there's any such term.
In our opinion, yes. At the time the assessment was made, the assessor made the decision that part of this property was not covered by a reservoir and therefore...
Did Mr. Bruner pay taxes on that?
Yes.
Assumption when the tax bill was given to him?
No.
No?
What happened in this case was the 50-acre parcel was part of the Bruner farm to the south, and it was considered all one parcel. And Mr. Kenton Bruner and his family before him paid taxes on the entirety of that parcel, which included the piece around this 21.1 acre reservoir bed. At some point, Mr. Bruner, about when he sold the property to the Beathys, went to the assessor and said, hey, wait a minute, I think I'm paying property on property to the north that's not in my legal description. Mm-hmm. The assessor did some research and separated the two parcels. It then determined that Benjamin Eaton was the owner of the 50-acre parcel and sent him a tax notice that went unpaid. It went unpaid for several years, which is what led to the tax sale in 1993 that then the Beathys purchased from the treasurer. And then 3 years after that, after the Beathys were paying the taxes on this 50-acre parcel, the treasurer went through the process to issue the treasurer's deed, and it wasn't for six more years that the petitioners came forward and tried to challenge that deed. So we're not talking about a case here where the petitioners were paying the taxes or were doubly taxed on this reservoir parcel.
Now do you think, or is there any evidence in the record that the petitioners knew about the taxation and had any notice of the deed whatsoever, of the tax deed?
There's a dispute in the record about whether or not they had actual notice. All of the petitioners testified they didn't have actual notice, but the assessor published a very long legal description that its only error was it omitted the section number, but it referred to Kern's Reservoir, which is what this Lake Canal Reservoir was also known at. Lake Canal's offices had maps and surveys all over their office that referred to this as Kern's Reservoir. And the notice, there was a physical piece of paper posted on the property, albeit under a rock, so it's disputed whether anybody actually saw that.
Well, what did the trial court make any findings on these factual issues?
The trial court, as I recall, found that notice was not properly given. I don't know if they specifically, if the trial court specifically found that the petitioners did not have actual notice.
Ms. Peters,
yes.
I'm sorry to be really ignorant here, but I can't remember. I have an Appendix A and a color exhibit. I don't quite get it. The yellow part is the 21.1 acres. Is that what the assessment, or is it Section 7, which the part that Hill claims adverse possession of? I don't understand what we're really talking about. And I don't understand the 93 acres.
The entire reservoir easement and or the reservoir decree for this property.
I'm sorry?
The reservoir decree in the water court.
Yes.
Includes a portion, in other words, there's a section line that comes right down the middle of this particular, that divides this property from property to the west.
Right.
The reservoir actually goes on both sides of that section line.
Okay.
The piece to the west is not an issue here. But that's encompassed it in the 93 acres that was part of the reservoir decree. As I recall, the yellow line is the outline of the 50-acre parcel described in the treasurer's deed. And I believe there's a green line from the yellow line down to the middle. There's a green line that delineates the northern section that Mr. Hill and Ms. Desiran claimed they adversely possessed.
And that's the 21.1 acres?
No, the 21.1 acres, as I understand from the assessor's testimony in the record, is what they consider the actual wet bed of the reservoir.
Oh, I see.
Which I believe you can see based on the outline of the water lines on that trial exhibit 3.
Thank you.
I think it's important to keep in mind here that the issue is not, did this tax deed convey good title? The issue is, can this tax deed be challenged beyond the statute of limitations? And I think that the court's cases up till now have all drawn the distinction between a deed that's void on its face and one that's not. I think it draws those distinctions for very good reason. If a deed is so defective that a casual observance of it can tell you, any observer, this deed is not effective. There was a defect in it somewhere. Either it was issued outside the authority of the treasurer because they did it too soon before the statute allowed. It's conveying property the treasurer didn't have authority to convey because it's conveying federal land, for instance, to somebody else. The treasurer wouldn't have authority to tax federal land. Those deeds can be challenged at any time because it puts the whole world on notice that there's something wrong with them. But on those deeds like the one we have in front of us today, where it's not clear from the face of the deed that there's something wrong with it, that's the deed that the statute of limitations is meant to apply to, so that at some point, even those deeds that are technically defective, for whatever reason, but appear on their face to be valid, can become a solid foundation for the title going forward.
What were the Beathys doing on this actual piece of property here for which they got the tax deed?
The Beathys considered that property part of their backyard. They were out there removing fences and making go-kart races, go-kart tracks for their kids. Mrs. Beathy.
So anybody coming out to check the reservoir would see that they were occupying that?
I believe so. Did
the court find that?
The trial court made no findings about the use and possession of this piece of property at the time of the lawsuit. The court was focused on the prior 18 years and the historical uses of the property based on competing uses of adverse possession. But it made no findings whatsoever about who was physically in possession of this property at the time the lawsuit was filed or at the time of trial. That's one of the issues in this case. It's the reason the Court of Appeals found we have to go back to the trial court, because it's the key issue now as to whether the statute of limitations applies. As the Court of Appeals found, this deed, because it's valid on its face, would be entitled to the protections of the statute of limitations if the Beathys can show they were in possession of the property at the time the lawsuit was filed. We believe the Beathys can on remand, and that's why we're here asking you to affirm the Court of Appeals opinion.
Could I ask you to stop right there a second while you're on that point? What do you think the statute of limitations means when it's introductory language? It says no action for the recovery of land, and that's what it applies to. What all does that include?
I think the five-year statute of limitations is meant to be a saving grace when someone takes a tax deed and is actually in possession of the property from someone else coming out years later and saying, wait a minute, that's really my land. It's meant to put a stopping point on how far out those deeds can be challenged when someone's in possession. And I think the court's prior cases make that clear, that that's what that section means.
And they do, I guess. And the Court of Appeals relied on that about a quiet title action if the holder of the deed is in possession. I'm not sure I understand. What is there about a quiet title action that is different or would exclude an action for the recovery of land?
I mean, I understand.
Does it matter if Hill, if the kind of action he files in order to establish his title and remove any clouds so that he can get the land back, does it matter if he files that as a quiet title action? In fact, what else would he file?
I think what the cases say is that you look not so much to the name of the action that's filed, but the remedy being sought. Is the remedy, I need to oust the people who are in possession so I can get it back? Or is it just that there's this vagrant wild deed out there we need to get off our title record? Both of those might be called a quiet title action, but the statute applies only to the instance where you've got somebody actually in possession you're trying to oust.
And so by in possession, does that suggest then if you're interpreting the language, no action for the recovery of land implies that someone else has to be in possession of it. That also implies, I guess, that the person who's bringing the action and who would be barred by the statute of limitations is not in possession or has been ousted from the land. Is that right? What would one have to show? What would you have to show that Hill is has brought an action for the recovery of land such that he would be barred by the statute of limitations?
I think what we'd have to show is that he's trying to set aside the deed under which the Beatheys took possession. And I think that possession they have to show is actual possession, meaning the same possession as an ordinary owner of that land would have used for it. Not that they went in and fenced it all out and kept everybody out and the same elements that might be necessary for adverse possession, but standard possession and use that a normal owner would make of that land.
Does this language imply anything about notice? As I proposed, one of the questions that was already asked you, is this statute of limitations limited to the situation then on its face in which the party bringing the action would have notice that someone else is occupying his land?
I don't think that notice has anything to do with that statute of limitations. I think the purpose of that statute of limitations is to give us certainty and reliability in the real property records once there's a deed recorded. And it shortens the time frame for people who are actually in possession using the land. So the challenge, if it comes at 4 years, for instance, wouldn't be as harsh as if it came 6 years and you've already been on that land. Legislator drew the line at 5 years. Nobody really knows why, I assume.
Let's assume the Beatheys are successful to establish if the Court of Appeals is, you know, the case goes back and they have the deed. Do they take the position it's not taxable, this portion? Because
no,
it's inundated by a reservoir?
We believe the initial assessment was correct, that only the portion that's actually used as a reservoir is exempt in this case because it's used by the owner of the water to irrigate its land, is exempt from taxation in this case.
But the surrounding
land would still be taxable.
Yeah, but part of this property is under the reservoir a couple months out of the year, right, that they're claiming a title to?
Not the entire property. I think when you look back at the testimony that was given, it goes to full capacity where it gets up to this berm, but it never fully subsumes the entire 50 acres. And I think that was a point of...
So it's the difference between the overall easement and the usable part that's in the reservoir?
Correct. I don't think it's fair to tell the assessor... you know, yes, we're using this property and it can be used even if it's 11 months out of the year for agricultural purposes and it yields a great crop, but we don't have to pay taxes on it because there happens to be a reservoir right above it. That seems to me that we're drawing a distinction and taking advantage of an exemption that was never meant to apply in that situation. The exemption as discussed or in the Shaw v. Bond case is if it's actually the reservoir bed or parts of the land actually used for purposes of that reservoir, then it's entitled to some sort of exception from the taxes only if that water is used by its owners to irrigate its land. We all know there are situations where water is not used for irrigation and it's sitting in a reservoir. There's a lot of situations where the statutes make it clear that the reservoir might be taxable, which brings me back to why this deed is not void on its face. The only reference to any reservoir property on the face of this deed is the little parenthetical that says 21.1 RES. And I think a casual observer looking at deed may not know that even refers to reservoir, let alone that it means a part of a reservoir might be being conveyed by that property. It certainly doesn't tell us from the face of the deed whether or not that reservoir on that property meets the statutory exception for taxation, that the water is used by its owners to irrigate its own lands. That water could be stored there for municipal uses, or recreational uses, for rental uses to somebody else. There's a lot of situations I can think of where that reservoir might be taxable under our state statute. And so I don't think you can look at the face of this deed and say to yourself, well, gee, it says RES, that must mean reservoir, and it must be, that must mean it's not subject to taxation, so this deed is void on its face. I think the Court of Appeals was correct when it said that invalid assessment is only made clear by extrinsic testimony that the trial court heard at trial. Without that extrinsic evidence, you can't tell this deed is invalid. The same holds true for the notice issues. You can't tell that the treasurer made the mistake of omitting the section number when it published notice from the face of this deed. You can't tell that it posted the notice on a rock as opposed to on a fence post when it posted notice of the issuance of the treasurer's deed. None of these things are visible from the face of the deed. When you look at the deed itself, it looks valid. And that's why it's entitled to the statute of limitations protection. And that's why the trial court erred when it first went through its analysis based on all this extrinsic evidence to determine the deed was invalid. And because the deed was invalid, the statute of limitations didn't apply. The question the trial court should have asked is the very first question in the Crisman opinion, which is this deed void on its face? And if it found it wasn't, the next question is, does the statute of limitations apply? And that's why we ended up in the Court of Appeals, and it's why we're here today. I would also point out that we're not asking for a rule that says, and I don't think the Court of Appeals adopted one, that says if a deed is valid on its face, it can never be challenged. Keep in mind here, we're talking about a lot of steps that have to go through. If an invalid assessment is made in the first place, there are several years before it goes to tax sale. There are several more years after tax sale before a treasurer's deed is even requested, and several more years before a tax deed can be issued. In this case, from the time of tax sale just to the tax deed, you're talking about 8 years where the owner of that property has the ability to come forward and challenge that deed. And come forward and say, hey, wait a minute, you've done this wrong. Or this wasn't a valid assessment. And these are not petitioners who are unfamiliar with real estate law or the taxation laws of property. This is a Lake Canal Reservoir Company whose easement was unaffected by this tax sale. Their easement is still in place today, the same as it was before this tax issue ever came up. And then we're talking about Mr. Hill and his sister. Mr. Hill, as I think the record makes clear, is a very experienced real estate lawyer with over 30 years of experience. He's well-versed in how to look up if a property is being taxed. And I think if an owner needs to take some responsibility, they can't sit on their rights for over 8 years and then come forward and say, hey, wait a minute, we were too late, but because there was an invalid assessment, you should let us challenge this deed, even though we're outside the statute of limitations. As a real estate lawyer, I'm particularly troubled by the rule the plaintiffs or the petitioners are advancing here, in which they're asking this court to allow deeds that are valid on their face, but for some reason, the taxing authority didn't have the power to issue to be challenged indefinitely. And that's the rule they're asking for. They're asking you to find a third exception in one sentence in the Crisman opinion that was not necessary to its holding and in which it describes examples that are clear on the faces of deeds to say that a deed that is issued outside the power of the taxing authority can always be challenged. And my question is then, where do you draw the line? And does that mean then that 50 years from now, someone can come in and say that deed the Beebe's got was outside the taxing authority's power and you should set it aside for it? And if the court can set it aside that late in time, how does a court unwind 50 years of transactions? And how then does any title company ensure property in which a tax deed appears in the chain of title? How does any real estate lawyer advise a client to rely on title they're getting where there's a tax deed in the chain of title if they're always subject to challenge? And that's the issue I think that's really pertinent here from a policy standpoint, is the reason we have statutes and limitations is to provide a cutoff point where somebody looking at these documents in the chain of title can say, okay, it's been more than 5 years. This deed has not been challenged. We have some sense of reliability and certainty that this deed can be relied on, and we as a title company can sure over it. We as a subsequent purchaser have some faith in buying it. We don't think down the road we're going to end up in court fighting over this deed. I would also add, I disagree with Mr. Lacuma, who mentioned on a couple of cases. I think The cases, first of all, from the other jurisdictions which were cited in the petitioner's briefs, are not really instructive. One, they don't really deal with void versus void on its face and voidable, which is really the issue that's in here. Those courts and those states don't seem to draw the same distinctions that Colorado has drawn for the last 100 years. They also have different statute of limitations. California and Oklahoma, for example, have 1 year statute of limitations, where there's a different policy consideration than for a court saying, on such a short statute of limitations, it makes some more sense to draw maybe further exceptions to a statute of limitations that it's not necessary for this court to draw, especially when those courts don't have the same bright line void on its face versus voidable distinctions. I also would point out this jurisdictional exception that petitioners are asking for, this third exception they say is appears in prison, troubles me partially for the reason Justice Coates has raised earlier about, well, what is a jurisdictional defect? Mr. LaPuma has indicated it might be that notice wasn't properly given. And in fact, there are cases he cites from New York and from Oklahoma where the courts have said just that. If notice is not properly given, that deprives the treasurer of power to issue the deed, and that's a jurisdictional defect. In Colorado, we have cases that say the exact opposite. If the notice is the defect, that makes the deed voidable, but it's still subject to the statute of limitations. And I don't see any reason why this court should undo the years of law we have now with this distinction between void on its face and voidable, simply because in this case it feels harsh to the petitioners. And that's really what I think they're asking you to do. I think what they're saying is the court should have the power to say, well, I don't think the statute of limitations should apply here because we don't like the result. That's really what their argument boils down to. Mr. LaPuma also mentioned the Sheasley case. Admittedly, I reviewed that last night, and as I read that case, it held the deed was void on its face because it didn't contain an affirmation about the power of the treasurer to issue it that was required of the form of the deed at that time. I don't think it stands for the proposition that Mr. LaPuma raised, and I would ask you to look at that closely.
Well, let me ask you this. What about all those reservoir companies that are out there that are actually used for mutual ditch and reservoir companies, collective people? Isn't the result you're asking for a threat to their status of being able to maintain those reservoir systems free of taxation and free of interference?
I don't think so. I think what this means is that they have some responsibility to be confirming with the assessor that what they think is not taxed is really not taxed. They have some affirmative obligation to make sure the assessor has treated their property correctly. And that's easy to find out. You look it up on the assessor's website. You go into the assessor and say, okay, these are all the reservoirs we say we own. Can you confirm for me how this is treated in the tax records? I can't confirm for you.
You're not just able to rely on what the law says, that they're exempt? I mean, why would you go checking about assessments when you know it's exempt? I don't understand that.
Well, I think in one instance, and what I'm not clear about is whether the assessor's office would actually send a notice of valuation, as they do every year, even if that valuation means we've determined this reservoir parcel, among all your others, has no value, but these parcels are taxed. So I think it's possible that some of these companies are getting valuations every year that would tell them whether it's being treated as an exempt property or not. With regard to whether if they don't get a valuation like that every year, it seems to me that the problem in this case is not so much that Lake Canal didn't get notice. It's that they didn't pay attention to what was going on with the property. In a situation like this where someone else is out there using it and there was a notice posted, there was a publication in a newspaper, I think these reservoir companies they have some obligation to not sit on their rights, not assume it's being treated as exempt, and to watch those tax notices to see if something referencing their reservoir comes up well in advance of 8 years or 9 years.
See, that's why I'm perplexed with this case in the first place, because your normal reservoir and ditch company is going to be out there constantly on the land to maintain it and make sure that it can be used for what it's used and keep off encroachments. So I don't quite understand how your clients can in effect occupy it as their backyard.
Well, I think
in the face of that kind of customary keeping after the property of reservoir property that these companies do?
I think in this case, and you'll read in the transcript, that this company wasn't out there every day. They weren't out there very often. There was a ditch rider who came out to clean on occasion, but it's not as if they were always on this property. If it was, they certainly would have seen the adverse possession use that made the basis for the transfer of property to the Hill, to Mr. Hill and Ms. Deseran, as well as the BP's use of the property as if it was their backyard. But I think what the answer to your question, maybe more importantly, is that's the reason we have the possession requirement. If that's the case, if they were really out there, and the trial court ultimately finds that the Beathys were not in possession of this property sufficient to invoke the statute of limitations, then the statute of limitations won't apply and the deed will be void. But that's a question for the trial court as to who was in possession at the time and whether or not the those concerns about who was actually out there using the property is really a finding the trial court needs to make, that it didn't in this case, and it should have in the first place. Had it done that first off, we wouldn't be here.
Okay, what does Hill use the property for?
As I recall the testimony, Mr. Hill and his predecessors used the property to graze cattle and to corral animals, as I recall.
But that apparently hasn't been recent activity.
I don't believe that was recent. I think all of that use was 50-some-odd years ago. I'd have to review the transcript to be sure of that, but as I recall, that testimony was use from several decades ago, not as recent as the time when the treasurer's deed issued. I might also draw the court's attention to a case cited by Mr. LaPuma in his reply brief, I believe, Elsis versus Centex Homes. He was citing it in support of this equity argument that we don't believe is appropriately in front of this court. But that case dealt with a long discussion about what a deed, when a deed is void versus voidable, and it was dealing with a concept of or a fact structure where an elderly person didn't have the mental capacity to enter into a contract. And in that case, although there were cases from other jurisdictions, and I believe the majority rule was that those types of deeds are void, this court held that deed, and in Colorado, those deeds are voidable. And the main reason, as I read that opinion, it did that, is because there's nothing in the contract itself that puts others on notice that there's an issue about capacity. And therefore, because there's nothing to give notice to someone else about that potential issue, that is a voidable document, contract, or deed. I think the same reasoning applies here. And I think that's the reason for 100 years we've had this distinction between void on its face and voidable. Where it's clear from the document and it gives people notice that there's something wrong with it, it makes sense not to apply a statute of limitations. But where it's clear, where there's nothing wrong with the face of the document, and it looks like title is accurate, and we get beyond the statute of limitations, and if all other requirements of that statute are met, there's no reason to draw another exception to the statute and let it be challenged further down the line, because I think doing that calls into great question the reliability and certainty of real property records that this court and the statutes and the legislature have made clear is the policy of this state. We therefore ask this court to affirm the Court of Appeals' opinion that this deed was not void on its face, and ask this court to remand it back to the trial court as the Court of Appeals directs. Thank you.
At this stage of the game, I guess I'm a little saddened that we're still arguing about the facts, but I want to put a couple of things to rest that were said here that I don't agree with. First, on this question of the possession of the property, particularly that you were asking about, Justice Hobbs, the Beathys did testify at trial that they used this property like their backyard. They took walks, they rode horses, they rode go-karts, etc. But there was also testimony from a lot of other people, including the ditch riders, the manager of the Lake Canal Reservoir Company, the tenant farmers who were on that property, even Beathys' own tenant farmer who farmed their land, all said We never saw them going around the lake. We saw them riding their go-karts on their own land. We saw them riding their horses on their own land, but they were never going around the lake. And the trial court, unfortunately, didn't make a conclusive finding. The trial court basically said in its order that the Beathys claimed that they took walks and had these occasional recreational uses, but nobody saw them doing this. And that's all the trial court said. They didn't make that final finding. We don't think that's possession. But here, I think based on all that testimony, even with them claiming to make these recreational uses of the property, they didn't possess the property. If you look at the case of Concord versus Huff that we cited in our brief, you'll see a long discussion of what constitutes possession, and that's not it. Occasional recreational uses is not possession. Now, even if they did have possession, we'd still be here, because this case isn't really about that. This case is about whether the issuing authority had authority to issue this tax deed, and whether this deed is void for all purposes or merely voidable, like the Court of Appeals said. And I'm running out of time, so I'm going to rely on those cases and other authorities. I mean, really, I gave you five different reasons to find that it is. The cases say it. The statutes say it. Other cases in other jurisdictions say it. This whole issue about Delsis and Upson and what we do with other cases, other deeds, whether they're void or voidable, those all lend, they all require that we find that this deed is absolutely void. And finally, I don't want you to forget about this constitutional consideration. You're talking about taking someone's land without process. You're talking about taking someone's land where the assessor admitted at trial, we did it wrong. We didn't assess this properly. We had no authority to issue this deed. And so that's what I'm hanging my hat on here. And I would ask you to reverse the Court of Appeals and find that this deed is absolutely void for all purposes and that the statute of limitations never got triggered. Thank you.
On behalf of the court, I want to thank counsel for your arguments. The case will stand. The court will be in